In an era where women's reproductive rights remain fiercely contested, Heather Marshall's debut novel, Looking for Jane, has emerged as a cultural touchstone. This powerful narrative weaves together the lives of three women across different decades, illuminating the hidden history of forced adoptions and underground abortion networks in Canada. Since its publication, the book has gained significant traction among feminist book clubs and reproductive rights advocates, with celebrities like Emma Watson and Margaret Atwood praising its unflinching portrayal of women's struggles. As the United States experiences a post-Roe landscape, Marshall's historical fiction has taken on an urgent contemporary relevance, serving as both a warning and a rallying cry for bodily autonomy. Angela Crichton's ordinary Wednesday afternoon at Thompson's Antiques and Used Books takes an extraordinary turn when she discovers a misdelivered letter wedged between the pages of a donated book. The letter, yellowed with age and written in a shaky hand, is from Frances Mitchell to her daughter Nancy, its contents revealing a truth that would shatter any family's foundations. Nancy, Frances confesses, was adopted from St. Agnes's Home for Unwed Mothers in 1968, and her birth mother, Margaret Roberts, never willingly surrendered her child. Frances's words tremble with decades of guilt as she details how she and her husband, Robert, had participated in what amounted to a forced adoption, taking advantage of a young woman's vulnerable position. Within the envelope, Frances had enclosed the most damning evidence, a handwritten note discovered in a pair of yellow baby booties, where Margaret had written in desperate hope, "My name is Margaret Roberts, and I am your mother. They told me I have no choice, but I will never stop loving you." This discovery resonates deeply with Angela, whose own adoption story led her through years of searching before finally finding her birth mother, Sheila, at age 28. Now at 35, Angela is weathering the emotional and physical toll of unsuccessful fertility treatments with her wife, Tina, their hopes of starting a family growing dimmer with each failed attempt. The parallel between Margaret's forced separation from her baby and modern struggles with fertility isn't lost on Angela, who sees how women's reproductive choices continue to be constrained, albeit in different ways. Despite Tina's practical concerns about interfering in strangers' lives, "We don't know if Nancy even wants to know," she cautions. Angela cannot shake the urgency she feels about this mission. The letter has awakened something fierce in her, a determination to right a historical wrong. She recognizes in Margaret's hidden note the same longing she once saw in her birth mother Sheila's eyes, that universal desire to connect with a child torn away. The letter becomes more than just a misdelivered piece of mail. It transforms into a thread weaving together three generations of women's stories, each marked by society's attempts to control their reproductive choices. From Margaret's forced surrender in the shame-filled 1960s to Angela's present-day struggle with fertility treatments, their narratives illuminate how women's bodies remain battlegrounds. As Angela begins her search for Nancy, combing through historical records and social media, she uncovers a web of connections far more intricate than she initially imagined. The investigation will lead her through dark chapters of local history, including St. Agnes's notorious past, while revealing how the echoes of past injustices continue to reverberate through multiple generations of women, ultimately offering the possibility of healing through truth and understanding. In October 1960, 20-year-old Evelyn Taylor arrives at St. Agnes's Home for Unwed Mothers, a forbidding brick manor that will forever change her life. Abandoned at the entrance by her father without so much as a goodbye, she's greeted by Sister Mary Teresa, whose cold eyes reflect the institution's punitive approach to fallen women. During her intake interview, Evelyn reveals she became pregnant by her fiancé, Leo, who died suddenly of a heart attack. Sister Teresa coldly informs her that she must surrender her baby for adoption to deserving couples, dismissing Evelyn's emotional plea to keep her child. The home operates like a prison. Residents use only first names, maintain complete privacy about their backgrounds, and follow rigid protocols designed to hide their shameful pregnancies. After giving birth, they must work for 3 months to pay their debt to the home. As Evelyn settles into the dormitory, she forms a forbidden friendship with another resident, Maggie Roberts, who shares her bed for warmth during the cold nights. Despite rules against personal connections, they exchange last names and dreams. Evelyn confesses her aspiration to become a doctor, perhaps specializing in hearts, inspired by Leo's tragic death. The girls at St. Agnes's each carry their own heartbreaking story. 15-year-old Louise impregnated by her brother's older friend, Anne abandoned by her husband. Under the supervision of nuns, they follow a military precise schedule of prayer, meals, chores, and early bedtime. Only Sister Mary Agatha shows any kindness, contrasting sharply with Sister Teresa's harsh treatment. The horror of St. Agnes's deepens when Evelyn overhears Sister Teresa discussing with Father LeClaire about adjusting the pricing for babies due to greater demand. Shocked that the home is selling babies like puppies from a kennel, Evelyn confronts Sister Teresa, who coldly reminds her that she's housed and fed in exchange for obedience and relinquishing her baby. When Evelyn suggests writing to her brother about adopting her child, Sister Teresa reveals she controls all outgoing mail, crushing Evelyn's hopes of keeping her baby. When Evelyn goes into labor, she's sent to the hospital alone in a taxi, a terrifying journey for a 17-year-old with no preparation or understanding of what lies ahead. Throughout her 18-hour labor, she endures the sterile isolation of the maternity ward, listening through paper-thin walls as nurses offer comfort and encouragement to other mothers. The contrast between their gentle reassurances to married women and the cold shoulder given to her is stark and deliberate. After delivering her daughter, Dr. Pritchard's clinical detachment reaches its peak as he coldly reminds her that she's going to make some nice couple very happy, reducing her profound loss to a mere transaction. Despite the institutional cruelty surrounding her, Evelyn experiences an overwhelming surge of love at first sight of her baby. The infant's tiny fingers, rosebud mouth, and dark curls etch themselves permanently into her memory. A compassionate nurse named Margaret, breaking protocol, allows Evelyn precious moments to hold and breastfeed her daughter. In that private sanctuary, Evelyn whispers the words she's held in her heart for months, "I've been waiting for you." These stolen moments become both a treasure and a torment in the years to come. During her mandated 5-day hospital stay, Evelyn makes daily pilgrimages to the nursery window, pressing her hands against the glass as she watches her daughter among the other newborns. One afternoon, she overhears two fathers discussing the babies, with the older man pointing out her daughter's conspicuous lack of name tag, explaining that's where they put the whore's babies. His casual cruelty pierces Evelyn's protective bubble, sending her fleeing back to her room, where the full weight of society's judgment crashes over her. The culmination of this systematic dehumanization occurs in the ironically named Goodbye Room, a stark space with institutional green walls where countless mothers before her have surrendered their children. As Evelyn hands over her swaddled daughter to Sister Agatha, her arms feel impossibly empty. The soft click of the closing door becomes the sound of her world ending. She collapses to the floor, her grief too massive to bear alone, finding minimal solace in Maggie's supportive embrace. Her primal scream of anguish reverberates through the home's corridors, causing the other girls to pause in their daily tasks, each recognizing her pain and anticipating their own impending losses. The weeks following are marked by debilitating grief that manifests physically, sleepless nights, loss of appetite, and a hollowness that seems to echo through her very being. When Evelyn finally musters the courage to confront Sister Agatha in the garden, desperately seeking any information about her daughter's whereabouts, the nun delivers what appears to be the final cruel blow. Her baby has died. This devastating news sends Evelyn reeling, her mind unable to process this unexpected tragedy as she stumbles back toward the house, her world permanently altered. This traumatic experience becomes the catalyst that transforms Evelyn from a vulnerable teenager into a passionate advocate for women's reproductive rights. The pain of her loss fuels a lifetime of activism, though she doesn't yet know that her path will eventually intersect with her daughter's life in ways that will challenge everything she believes about that fateful time. In summer 1979, 19-year-old Nancy Mitchell's life takes a dramatic turn when she accompanies her cousin Clara to an illegal abortion that goes horribly wrong. After the procedure, Clara becomes unresponsive on the subway, and Nancy discovers the seat beneath Clara is soaked with blood. Panicking, Nancy drags her semi-conscious cousin off at Ossington Station and hails a taxi to St. Joseph's Hospital. At the hospital, an angry male doctor confronts Nancy, accusing her of helping Clara attempt an illegal abortion and threatening to call the police. When his shift ends, a more sympathetic female doctor, Dr. Gladstone, takes over. She agrees to record Clara's condition as a spontaneous miscarriage and offers Nancy crucial advice. If she or anyone she knows needs help with an unwanted pregnancy in the future, they should call doctor's offices and ask for Jane. Though confused by this cryptic message, Nancy is relieved that Clara will survive and that they've avoided legal trouble. A year later, Nancy's own world shatters when she discovers a small brown leather case hidden in her parents' bedroom drawer. Using her birth date as the combination, she finds Margaret Roberts' note inside yellow baby booties. "My name is Margaret Roberts, and I am your mother." This discovery forces Nancy to question everything: why Margaret gave her up if she didn't want to, why she hasn't found Nancy, and who Nancy truly is now. As Nancy wanders through her childhood home, haunted by memories, she finally speaks aloud the truth: "My name is Jane." Unable to confront her parents that night, she leaves, knowing that for the rest of her life, guilt and betrayal will smell like her mother's lemon dish soap. This discovery of her adoption creates a profound identity crisis for Nancy, one that will influence her decisions about reproduction, relationships, and her involvement in the underground abortion network that gives women choices she never had. In spring 1971, Evelyn Taylor, who survived her suicide attempt after losing her baby and has now become a doctor, attends a knitting club meeting at a United Church with her colleague Alice. They're greeted by Jeanette, who welcomes them as potential medical volunteers for an underground abortion service. In the church basement, they join about a dozen women led by Holly, who reports they've helped nearly 1,000 women access abortions but still struggle with demand. The meeting features Lillian, a guest speaker who shares her devastating story of being raped by her stepfather and denied a legal abortion despite the circumstances. Her testimony deeply affects Evelyn, who privately recalls her own painful pregnancy experience. Moved by the urgent need for more doctors and remembering her involvement with the abortion caravan protest in Ottawa, Evelyn stands up and volunteers herself and Alice, mentioning her training under Dr. Morgan Teller. Holly welcomes them to the Jane Network, marking their official entry into the underground abortion service. Years later, in 1981, Nancy finds herself on the other side of the Jane Network when she needs an abortion herself. After the procedure, police officers arrive to search the clinic. Dr. Taylor quickly sets up the room to appear as though Nancy is there for a routine pap test. When Officer Perneth and his colleagues enter, Nancy abandons the script in a burst of anger, bluntly telling them she's getting a pap test and would rather be at a hockey game. Her boldness impresses Dr. Taylor and Alice, who provide her with aftercare instructions and a card with just a phone number, instructing her to tell them to ask for Jane if she needs to refer friends. Nancy later encounters Dr. Taylor outside a nursing home and impulsively asks how she can volunteer with the Janes. Despite Dr. Taylor's warnings about the criminal risks, Nancy passionately argues that women deserve better options, declaring, "The Janes changed my life. I'd like to join." This decision connects her to the underground network fighting for women's reproductive rights and unknowingly brings her into the orbit of her birth mother's friend. The Jane Network operates with military precision and secrecy, constantly moving locations to avoid detection. In July 1984, Nancy joins Dr. Taylor and Alice at a fourth-floor apartment in Chinatown that serves as their temporary clinic. The Janes discuss their current patient and the challenges of their work, including no longer allowing companions after a Montreal clinic was raided. Their conversation is interrupted when Patricia arrives for her appointment. Nancy follows protocol, explaining the procedure in detail. Suddenly, a strange screech reveals Patricia is wearing a recording device. She pulls out a gun, revealing herself as an undercover police officer, and forces Nancy out at gunpoint to where Alice and Dr. Taylor are waiting. The three women find themselves in a police van after being arrested. Despite the dire situation, they work together to destroy evidence, chewing and swallowing the patient list Evelyn had hidden in her waistband. At the station, they meet Selena Donovan, a formidable lawyer who expertly challenges the sergeant's authority during interrogation. When they play the undercover officer's recording meant to incriminate them, they discover it's mostly unintelligible due to technical issues. With no evidence to hold them, Selena confidently walks them out of the station. This dramatic raid illustrates the extraordinary risks these women took to provide reproductive health care when it was criminalized. Their willingness to face imprisonment demonstrates their deep commitment to women's bodily autonomy, a commitment that becomes even more meaningful on January 28, 1988, when the Supreme Court of Canada strikes down abortion restrictions in the landmark Morgenteller decision. On that historic day, Evelyn sits in a coffee shop near Morgenteller's clinic, reflecting on her career with the Janes. Tomorrow will be her first day performing abortions without fear of imprisonment. When a young waitress recognizes Evelyn as Jane and asks what she'll do now that abortion is legal, Evelyn simply replies she'll continue her work as long as women need her. Asked if women will always need these services, Evelyn reflects on all her patients' varied stories before answering wearily, "Yes, there will always be a need." Throughout the novel, secrets operate as both a shield and a corrosive force, gradually eroding the foundations of relationships and trust. Nancy's discovery of her adoption serves as the catalyst that fractures her marriage to Michael, particularly when she finally reveals her clandestine involvement with the Jane Network. Their confrontation becomes increasingly heated as Michael, feeling betrayed, accuses her of recklessly endangering their future family through her illegal activities. The argument exposes deeper fissures. Nancy realizes their mutual trust was always built on shifting sand. Michael's reaction reveals his fundamental distrust of her judgment, while she recognizes she can never fully confide in him. This revelation leads Nancy to a profound understanding of her parents' decades-long silence about her adoption. She comes to see that the internal damage from keeping secrets is far more controllable than the external damage of revealing them. The pain of carrying a secret, while considerable, remains contained and manageable. Once exposed, secrets take on a life of their own, spreading unpredictably like ripples in still water, affecting relationships in ways that can never be undone. The theme of destructive secrecy extends into 2010, when Nancy faces the task of clearing out her mother's house following Francis's death. The moment she approaches, the drawer containing the leather case becomes charged with decades of unspoken truths. Francis's death creates a permanent barrier. Nancy can never ask the questions that have haunted her, never hear her mother's explanation for the choices made so long ago. The empty leather case she discovers feels like Francis's final act of protection or perhaps control. She must have removed Margaret's note, anticipating Nancy's eventual discovery. In her own role as a mother, Nancy attempts to forge a different path with her daughter, Catherine, consciously working to break the generational pattern of secrecy. Yet she still maintains the big one, the truth about her adoption, revealing how deeply ingrained these patterns of concealment become. The weight of secrets has exacted a heavy toll on her life, contributing to the collapse of her marriage to Michael and creating an invisible barrier between her and Catherine. The novel powerfully contrasts the destructive force of secrets with the transformative potential of truth when Nancy finally shares her adoption story with Catherine. This revelation opens new possibilities for healing, with Catherine encouraging Nancy to reconsider her relationship with Michael, suggesting that neither has found happiness in the aftermath of their divorce. During their coffee meeting, Nancy makes the conscious choice to embrace honesty, sharing the truth about Jane and agreeing to meet Margaret's friend. This decision marks a turning point, a commitment to stop allowing secrets to corrode her relationships, and a recognition that while truth might be painful, it offers the only path to authentic connection. In spring 2017, Angela's persistence finally pays off when she connects with Nancy Birch, who confirms she's the former tenant above Thompson's Antiques. Angela explains about finding the letter, only to discover Nancy already knows she's adopted. She'd found Margaret's note years ago, but noticed it was missing when cleaning out her mother's house. Angela gently breaks the news that Margaret died shortly after Nancy's birth and offers to connect Nancy with Evelyn Taylor, who was Margaret's friend at the maternity home. Meanwhile, Angela visits Evelyn, bringing brownies as a peace offering. As they discuss Margaret Roberts and her daughter, Evelyn suddenly turns pale and begins trembling. After Angela comforts her, Evelyn makes a shocking revelation. "I was at St. Agnes's too. I gave birth to a baby girl there. She was stolen from me after just a few days in my arms." As Evelyn traces a long scar on her wrist, she reveals the truth. "My name was Maggie then, and my baby's name was Jane." This stunning twist reveals that Dr. Evelyn Taylor is actually Margaret Maggie Roberts, who didn't die by suicide as reported, but escaped the maternity home with Sister Agatha's help after being told her baby had died. She changed her identity to Evelyn Taylor and dedicated her life to helping women have reproductive choices, never knowing that her daughter Nancy had been right beside her in the Jane Network all those years. When Angela reveals that Nancy Mitchell is Evelyn's biological daughter, Evelyn is stunned. The memories rush back. Nancy on her exam table, Nancy holding the door at St. Agnes's, Nancy joining the Janes alongside her in the abortion rights movement, Nancy facing down a gun with her. Her daughter had been right beside her all along. In the novel's emotional climax, Evelyn prepares anxiously for Nancy's arrival, washing laundry repeatedly and changing outfits 4 times before settling on a yellow blouse matching the booties she'd knitted for baby Jane. When the doorbell rings, Evelyn freezes as Angela brings Nancy upstairs. Seeing her daughter's aged but familiar face, Evelyn, now mentally referring to herself as Maggie again, embraces Jane as decades of separation dissolve. "I've been looking for you," Jane says through tears as they finally reconnect. Marshall's novel powerfully illustrates how the personal is political through these interconnected women's lives. The maternity home system, though fictional in the novel, represents countless real post-war institutions in Canada and the U.S. These government-funded homes, primarily run by churches, expanded when adoption demand for white babies surged after World War II. Women described being called inmates, coerced into signing adoption papers, falsely told their babies had died, and prevented from seeing their newborns. Similarly, the Jane Network portrayed in the novel draws inspiration from underground abortion networks worldwide, particularly Chicago's Abortion Counseling Service of Women's Liberation. The detail of volunteers eating patient records to protect identities during police raids was based on actual practices. In Canada, abortion was legalized in 1988 through the R.V. Morgenthaler Supreme Court decision after years of provincial battles, including the real-life abortion caravan protest of 1970, where women delivered a symbolic coffin to Prime Minister Trudeau's house and chained themselves to railings in Parliament. The novel's conclusion brings the narrative full circle, with Angela, who started the chain of revelations by finding the misdelivered letter, experiencing her own reproductive joy. After numerous failed fertility treatments, Angela and Tina discover they're expecting twins. The sound of the dual heartbeats becomes the most beautiful sound Angela has ever heard, a perfect harmony. Yet Marshall's novel serves as both a celebration of progress and a warning about its fragility. Writing from Canada, where abortion access seems relatively secure, Marshall describes her despair when Roe v. Wade was overturned in 2022, turning what she wrote as historical fiction into a horrifyingly relevant contemporary issue. She firmly states her belief that people inherently own rights to their own bodies and should access abortion at any time for any reason without conditions. Through these three women's interconnected stories spanning six decades, Looking for Jane reminds us that reproductive freedom remains an ongoing struggle, one that requires vigilance, courage, and the willingness to speak truth to power, even when doing so comes at great personal risk.